Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us from Jerusalem for today's weekly update. Malcolm, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. It's good to be with you and to be able to be in Jerusalem at the same time.
As usual, we will begin by getting a report on the conditions in Jerusalem. You know we're waiting for another mini snowstorm here. I assume that there's no snow in the Holy Land.
No snow, beautiful sunshine, windy, but otherwise beautiful.
Just incredible. And the Conference of Presidents mission went from Paris, where they were last week, now to Jerusalem. I assume the week was filled with comprehensive meetings and discussions.
It was very full from Monday morning till Thursday night. Literally, I think we went at least 19 or 18 hours a day. We met with all of the leadership, the president, prime minister, the heads of the major parties, including Bennett and Lapid, briefings. We traveled with the mayor of Jerusalem to the hotspots, looking at E1 and from these rare observation points, being able to see the real story about where Ramat Shlomo and the things we read about. And I have to tell you that there wasn't a person who came back and didn't say that this is completely different from what they had anticipated their understanding, or for the first time they were able to visualize what they had been reading about and saw how ridiculous so much of the coverage, especially E1, which is just this little barren three hills that have never been settled, never been lived on, and yet the whole world has become focused on it. We really had a wide array of briefings from the foreign ministry, from the IDF up north, to see what the situation was. It's a busy time here.
Some of the people in your group have real strong connections to members. You got to get that?
No, okay.
Is that part of the espionage scandal in Israel? Are you waiting for an update from somebody? You have members that traveled with you who have strong connections to members of mass media. I would hope that they would take this opportunity, especially in regard to what you just said about E1 and Ramat Shlomo, to convey these messages to those members of the media.
It's very important, and you're absolutely right. We do have people, and we've gotten a lot of press coverage, as I'm sure people have seen, those who follow these things. But the it's an opportunity to help clarify and to rectify some of the disinformation, misinformation, misunderstanding. And the problem is that the media is, by and large, indifferent to it. I mean, it's not a story.
That's true.
They can't scandalize it.
Yeah, we heard you on Gal Eitzal, the nerve of you to go to another radio station. All right, so tell me, I don't understand anything about these spy cases. It's so hard for me to follow. The only thing I could say is my curiosity about this whole Prisoner X thing, Ben, I forgot his last name at this point, who's been identified.
Ziegler.
What is it?
I think Ziegler.
Ziegler. Here's my curiosity about this case. Is this an isolated episode? Are you getting the feeling that this is being replicated in many other countries by those who are staunch Zionists who think they are doing what's best for the state of Israel?
Well, I don't think this is being replicated because apparently he engaged in some sort of inappropriate behavior in perhaps even turning into double agents or selling weapons to Iran or something else that has been reported in the press. There are various stories that have been current, but nothing obviously coming from the government itself, so we don't have a full report. I do assume that at some point we will. So I don't think there are people doing that. There are obviously people who are risking their lives for the Jewish state, as there are for the United States, as there are for virtually every other country, who work in the security or intelligence agencies to get the information. I mean, how is it that Israel knows where to bomb in Gaza when, you know, you have to do pinpoint bombing? So there's information from drones and from spy satellites, but there's also information gathered on the ground, and that's from friends or from Israelis who cross over or go into Syria today or in other places.
All right,
out of necessity.
I know it's unfair to ask you to speculate about a number, so you don't have to answer it in that way. But I, again, my curiosity is how large is the Israeli spy network. I mean, it could be...
They're not spies. First of all, you can have intelligence officers that are legitimately gathering information.
And we don't call them spies when they're unknown to those to the adversaries?
Well, I mean, I think we don't call them spies. They probably would be called spies by others. But, for instance, Israel does not spy on the United States. Israel, has more need for information from surrounding countries that threaten to destroy it. So it's information gathering. With spy satellites, operate also. People operate them. So intelligence gathering is something every country engages in. Some just do it better, some do it worse. And no matter how good they are, there are glitches that occur, or there are people who cannot sustain it, and some who end up in prison because they decided to take the wrong turn.
How would you evaluate the impact, and you're in Israel right now, how would you evaluate the impact that this story has had on Israeli society? Is it all over the place or nobody really cares?
It's the lead story everywhere. It's also the lead story in Europe. Was only surpassed because the guy who ran on the Iron Blades supposedly killed his girlfriend, right, who was a model, or some other scandal that at least competes or knocks it off the lead story. But it is the subject of major focus here, and as I said, abroad as well, because it's television brought to life. Right. When you see this, it's almost like a reality show you're watching because of all the speculation about what did he do, and that he was from Australia and working in other places, and did he become a double agent, did he become a triple agent or a single agent?
And how different was the result of the censorship criteria or protocol? The censorship protocol in Israel was handled a lot differently than it would have been years ago. We probably would never have learned his identity years ago, am I right?
Well, the Australian paper broke the story, so obviously somebody here gave them the information. The Israeli press was prohibited from discussing it for the first, I think, 48 hours, and only later were permitted to disclose more information.
But so the only reason we know about it is because today people... The only reason my theory might be right is because today people dig deeper and will not settle for not finding out who it is.
Well, it's easier, and especially because of the internet,
right,
the instant access to information, and because it's very hard to control the flow of information, there is good reason not to have it, perhaps not to embarrass the family, not to put them through more pain, in addition to other considerations.
Does this story hurt anybody politically?
No, not particularly that I can see so far, but it does. It's obviously an embarrassment, and it's a distraction at a time before the president's coming, and many other things are on the agenda.
And on the subject of espionage, I don't know if this is a proper transition or not, Mike Huckabee has called for the president during his March trip to Israel to use that opportunity to pardon Jonathan Pollard. What did you think of Huckabee's recommendation?
Well, we've taken a similar position, not just for this, because of the trip, but because we're approaching now the 10,000th day, I know that Jonathan was not well this past week and fainted again in prison. He doesn't have medical problems, and it's just ludicrous. And when you see the op-ed piece written by one of those who was involved in this prosecution, who said that he would never support his release, who now calls and says it's ridiculous, it's disproportionate, it's time to let him go, we are reminded of the injustice that's being done at this point to Mr. Pollard, and called on the president and call on him to let Jonathan go. Let him go before the visit. Let him go at any time now that as soon as possible.
And no doubt it'll come up in conversation with the prime minister. Speaking of conversation,
I know President Peres told me that he will raise it strongly, and I'm sure the prime minister will.
And speaking of conversations with the prime minister, I assume you saw the prime minister at some point this week, right?
Yes, we did.
And as he faces the group after what was somewhat of a humbling experience in this past election, right? He did not garner the type of support that certainly the polls thought he might, and some of the conjectures out there, pre-election. Does he seem a little bit more humbled? Is he speaking about the negotiations with the other parties in a different manner than before the election?
Well, I wouldn't say he's humbled or cowed by the results. I think he's under a lot of pressure right now because he wants to get the government together, and now he has a deadline to do it before the president's visit. And there are many who are predicting that they may have to go to elections before again.
What do you mean elections again?
Very difficult negotiations with some of the parties. But that's inevitable, I guess, in these kind of negotiations, that when there's a lot at stake and when you have, you know, new parties, people who are not necessarily experienced in the political give and take, and there's a lot of personal agendas that come into play here as well. So I found the Prime Minister gave a really a wonderful speech and spoke about the issues very clearly, including Iran, some of the domestic agenda, and did not appear to be any different, I think.
And when you mean elections, you mean what you referred to last week, another election in 2013, you mean? You don't mean in the next month?
No, there are people who told me, including some experienced political observers, who said they don't think this government, that he may not be able to form a government, or that it will not last long.
That would be unbelievable if the former is the case. Did he tip his hand at all in terms of direction for defense minister, finance minister, and foreign minister?
Well, he can't right now. There's a lot of speculation, and names are being bandied about. But until they know the coalition, everything else is irrelevant.
Right. And Victor Lieberman does think that he's holding that foreign ministry position for him till after all these indictment situations are over with.
Well, or they may have somebody who will fill in, or have some temporary arrangement. But now he's chairman, I think, of the Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee, or the acting chairman, until the permanent arrangements are made in the Knesset.
Did the topic of the army draft come up in your group's meeting with the prime minister?
No, it came up in many other sessions with Yair Lapid, with Bennett, with Rabbi Parish of United Torah Judaism, and others who spoke before the conference. The share the burden concept, as they call it now. I think people are trying to be realistic about this. They don't want all of the Haredi. They can't use all of them. There are, Rabbi Parish, in his speech, said, look, if they don't go to work, if they're not going to really learn, then they should go to work, go to the army and go to work.
Right.
He said there has to be national service. If they're learning Torah, that's national service. But if not, they should go into the army. He was in the army. And it's interesting, we were watching some maneuvers, special maneuvers that were put on for us about the counterterrorism, and two of the guys had payas, who were in the unit that we were watching.
Go figure, huh?
The issue is obviously still front and center. The election was about the domestic agenda, not the international agenda, where there is a broad consensus, I think, and no doubt will be a priority issue in the new Knesset that could be divisive.
And we referred to it months ago basically as a deadlock issue, to the point where they tabled it, right? They basically postponed it to the next government. Is it possible we're heading down that road again? Because from the way you're presenting it this morning, it sounds like people are more anxious to get this done with some type of deal.
I think that is true, that people do want to get it done. Some of the political leaders have been meeting, even between Shas and other parties or individuals, in an effort to come up with a plan that could garner the broadest support, address the issue, the inequities that people feel very strongly about, but at the same time allow all the parties to be able to walk away and say we have a livable solution.
All right. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, 91.9 FM in Rockland County, where we'll be celebrating at Ashar this coming Wednesday morning up in Rockland County, and, of course, around the world on the web at jmtheam.org. Monday's President's Day, we will be here at JM the AM. Make sure to be tuned in. Don't forget today, right after JM the AM on our stream, Naomi Nachman with Table for Two between 9 and 10. Jay Buxbaum is our guest between 9 and 10 this morning. And then, of course, Kedem presents an amazing Erev Shabbos music mix that is the best way to prepare for on an Erev Shabbos that goes from 10 a.m. Eastern Time all the way until candlelighting at jmtheam.org. When we hear of meetings between Jerusalem and Cairo regarding security, Gaza Strip, border with Egypt, etc., is that a good thing or a bad thing?
No, it's good. While there's no contact and this is part of the misunderstanding that people hear about these meetings. This is not with the Morsi government. This is with the Army. And the Army, the relationship with the Army has been ongoing, was described to us by people we met and others that they actually sustained the cooperation regarding the Gaza Strip and the Sinai. And there were efforts by the Egyptian Army, by the way, to destroy some of the tunnels, the Gaza tunnels, and they dug a well there, which they hooked up, to which they have hooked up a hose and try to flood some of these illegal tunnels. That is not to say that the relationship is good. The relationship is still very tense because of the statements by the leaders of Egypt, the cold peace, the some of the steps that they've taken in relation with Hamas and with other groups. But the most important aspect, of course, is the security relationship immediately. And Morsi cannot afford to lose the U.S. aid. Its economy, according to all the later reports, is continuing to deteriorate with less than $15 billion in reserves, the hotel industry, the tourism industry destroyed. The unemployment rate continues, 1.5 million babies a year and 1.5 million new unemployed people a year.
Right.
And this is, so Egypt, for Israel, obviously is very important. And the fact that they still coordinate and that the army sustains it is very good.
Malcolm, when a Jewish teenager asks you today if Egypt and Israel are allies, what's the answer?
Well, they have a peace treaty, but I think allies implies something much more, that they're cooperating and engaged in common efforts. I think Egypt has made clear that where the limits are, and because it's a desire for U.S. aid and not to lose it, they won't abrogate the agreement, as many have called for. The statements and the incitement kind of things that we've seen are obviously very disturbing and not the kind of thing an ally does to another ally.
Hassan Shateri was the victim of the targeted assassination. It was his association with Hezbollah that caused his demise?
I think Shateri was killed somewhere along the Syrian-Lebanese border. He was the IRGC, the Iran Revolutionary Guard chief in Lebanon. Whether he was there supervising the troops, the Hezbollah troops, but it certainly substantiates the depth of their involvement inside Syria, fighting against the rebels, fighting for Assad. They are also there, perhaps, looking for weapons, taking, as we know, that they covered some of the long-range missiles, chemical weapons, other things that Syria has, in which everybody else is watching. We know that the Russians still are selling arms, and there's a huge Russian maneuver now, but more importantly, the foreign minister of Syria was in Russia, and they announced a strategic partnership at this time, which is really quite remarkable. And there are the Russians have been playing a very nefarious and questionable role throughout. We're seeing the help to the Egyptian militia that the IRGC is giving, training people in Egypt to act like the Basiji. And there's reports that that Hamas has sent people in with Qatar backing to into Egypt, and they're certainly deeply involved inside Syria today.
And just to bring this conversation somewhat a full circle, without reliable Israeli intelligence, it would have been impossible to take out Shateri, correct?
Well, I don't know that Israel took it out. We know that he met quick demise, and nobody has said that they were responsible.
Care to speculate, Malcolm?
Well, I could take a wild guess, but...
boy.
You know, this is a very serious matter.
How many have we seen in the last few months?
The infrastructure that the IRGC and that the Hezbollah is building, rather, inside the southern Lebanon. There have been reports of movement of new construction in the Shiite villages and Sunni villages, rather. And the Christian villages have remained the same or grown smaller. There's massive building because they're giving cheap housing to people in exchange for them committing to having one room be the missile room in their house. And the concern is that the network of underground tunnels is massive inside southern Lebanon. It's made so that these terrorists can live in them for a year. There's enough food and showers and all sorts of facilities way underground, which means that the IDF, should they need to, would have a harder time finding them. And on the other hand, they place their rockets and everything in civilian buildings and populations in order to draw fire on them.
We sort of got used to all the targeted, what seemed to be targeted assassinations of Iranian scientists, right? But in addition to that, there are targeted assassinations of terrorist leaders as well. How many would you think have taken place, I don't know, since the beginning of 2012? Have we seen between 5 and 10 of these terrorist leaders being taken out?
Well, you don't know the circumstances under which they are eliminated. The use of drones has certainly enabled Israel, for instance, in Gaza and during the war, to eliminate some of those who are firing the rockets, which is a purely illegal means of self-defense. They've been used in other places, too. I'm sure, you know, we reported that in Syria and along the Syrian border with Israel, we have a new fence, and where there were big maneuvers this week that we saw, that the use of drones and things like that to identify any kind of movement of weapons or to identify movement of personnel is really quite important.
All right, so we may see an even bigger increase in this type of activity as the information and the technology becomes even more.
And also as the tension in Syria builds, we see that the Druze are shifting from the support of Assad to the other side. We know that the Alawites and others in the army are remaining adamant and supportive because they feel that they don't have any alternative. But it's, you know, we see the calls for new efforts. Secretary Kerry called for new initiatives against the Assad, but providing assurances for Assad and for the Alawite communities. The Iran and Hezbollah are still building their networks in the region, and particularly in Syria and Lebanon. This is it's a base of operation that you know doesn't affect just their activities in Lebanon, but the whole region, and particularly for Israel, it's a cause of concern.
Would you call Kerry's stand on North Korea a tough stand?
Well, I think his call is very important, not just vis-a-vis North Korea, but also in regard to Iran. When he said, if you say things, they have to mean something.
Right.
And his call for, you know, action against North Korea. But we have to understand that that what North Korea did is Iran doing it. And you know how many times I've said this over the years, so those who listen regularly are probably getting bored of it. But they have to understand there's a synergistic relationship between North Korea and Iran. When Iran tests things, it's for North Korea as well. When North Korea tests these bombs, you can be sure that Iranian agents are there. We know they were there, that it could be a contract test. Or just part of the joint venture of the evil axis of evil, as President Bush called it. So the secretary's remarks, Secretary Kerry's remarks, are important because it at least indicates they understand that what's important is the perception that the Iranian leaders get. And if they don't believe, as many have said, they don't believe that the military option is credible. And especially the removal of the U.S. aircraft carrier from the Persian Gulf, which has to send the wrong message at a time when we see the reports that they were buying tens of thousands of these highly specialized magnets, which would be enough to run 50,000 centrifuges, which is more than five times what they have today. I saw reports that the Iranians were taking their secret documents out of Syria, but at the same time are continuing to apply them with weapons and sending in their own troops in the IRGC and Hezbollah to fight there. So, you know, the situation that the secretary is addressing, the question is, what are they going to do?
Right.
Are they going to, if the Iranians conclude that the U.S. will not use force and that the West in general won't use force, the sanctions themselves are hurting, they're having an impact. But you have a birth. What's interesting, by the way, in Iran is that the birth rate is dropping precipitously. But the economic conditions of the people has deteriorated, but the government continues to make $40 or $50 billion, which they can spend on their international terrorist activities.
I'm very curious to see when the President of the United States speaks in Jerusalem how he handles the topic of military option. He's going to have to say something, right?
Well, he did not in his State of the Union, as compared to last year, did not talk about, he put the emphasis on diplomacy, but he right. didn't say, you know, in the military, the all options are on the table and talk tough about that. He did not do that in this State of the Union. By the way, we should note that the one issue that got both sides of the aisle and sustained applause was the support for the relationship with Israel.
Right.
In the president's speech.
Right, and often he leaves out too much when it comes to foreign policy. Thought he did pretty well this time around. The protests in Jordan, do they get less attention because the government, as opposed to the early Arab Spring demonstrations and what we saw in Egypt, certainly, and now in Syria, do they get less attention because people are not as anti-government as in the other countries?
Well, they were. The kings usually have it easier, and the demonstrations, the intensity of the demonstrations there or Morocco and other places with monarchs is usually more limited because they have special status. They're also supposedly direct descendants of Muhammad. But what's happening in Jordan is very, very significant. This can affect the whole region, and the king has adopted this evolutionary policy to slowly change the system, introduce more reforms. The Muslim Brotherhood called for a boycott of the elections and therefore, you know, didn't run. But they are increasingly vocal, and the demonstrations for the first time targeting the king in recent months. The king is using the social networks. He's trying all sorts of means to try to introduce some reforms. But the situation there, the stability of Jordan, is vital to Israel's security, to the Gulf, to everyone, and it would bring Iran essentially to Israel's border. So it's very critical, and it's very worrisome.
And the president does or does not visit Jordan next month?
He does.
Oh, so he'll go?
He visits the PA, Jordan, and Israel.
So what impact will that have when he shows up there, or nothing great?
Well, it will show support, which is very important to the king, and... I don't know how impressed people will be, but the visit of a president of the United States is a demonstration of solidarity, and I think that the same thing is true in terms of the visit to Israel. You know, people kept asking for 4 years why he doesn't go, and then when he goes, they ask, why is he going? Right. And I think there's so much speculation, and I kept saying to them, you know, what's the basis of the assumptions that he's coming with Middle East peace plans or other things? I don't believe that's the case. I do believe he's doing this early on in both administrations in order to try and set the tone better to coordinate on the vital issues. Like, we know it's going to be Iran, we know it's going to be Syria, as Netanyahu told us, and also reaching out to the PA, but you have nobody on the Palestinian Authority side who's ready to respond to that outreach. So I don't think you're going to see any kind of a summit meeting or anything of that kind during the upcoming visit. Clearly, Syria, the deteriorating situation, who knows by then where they will be, as we see, you know, areas of Damascus falling to the wrong side, to the rebel side. And maybe even plans by Assad to move, to give up on Damascus and move to an Alawite enclave that they wanted to build. But the visit of the president, he will be giving a speech to the Israeli people. I know several places were contacted to see whether they're about the most suitable. And Israelis are going to be watching it very carefully. But it's an important message when he visits Iron Dome about the joint security of the United States and Israel, the joint cooperation, the joint efforts, not just the negatives that get so much attention, but the overwhelming preponderance of positives in the U.S.-Israel relationship on a day-to-day basis between the military, intelligence, R&D, agriculture, you know, science, and so many areas that get little attention.
Yeah, that can't be overemphasized. By the way, you know there's a group of people who are not that happy about his March 20th visit.
We don't know the exact date yet, but you're right. There are people who are not happy about it, and here as well in Israel.
Yeah, but I'm speaking on a much
we
more...
We want to see it the best face put on it, because we want the world to see the
United States
and Israel together.
Malcolm, let me get this line in. But I'm talking on a much more practical level. Pesach is Monday night, and the store owners who are anticipating a lockdown in Jerusalem are furious that he's showing up the Wednesday before. I'm not kidding. Someone said that to me. And people in Israel are furious. What's he showing up now? Are you kidding? One of our biggest business days of the year.
And I'm sure they'll get compensation.
Yeah, call FEMA. And you know... And you know that city's going to be on lockdown when he shows up. You know it.
Can you imagine him sending the list of all the matzahs that they have left over? More strategy.
I'll tell you. Here, you take the case of macaroons. We couldn't sell it because of you. By the way, have you paid any attention to the Hegel nomination process while you're there? Because it's getting
complicated. Absolutely. Follow it every minute. You know, they find more stuff all the time that's getting more heated. And, again, the focus should be on his record and on Iran and what we can expect, as Lindsey Graham said. But also, they found another speech where he made a really unacceptable comment about State Department being controlled by the Israel's Foreign Ministry or something like that in 2007, I think.
Yeah, I think it was 08, and I kept to your policy of don't believe everything you read, but if you're confirming that it was really him, then I guess that's it.
Well, I'm in Israel, so I haven't been able to hear a tape of it, but
right.
Of course, nobody has so far denied it.
Right, understood. Prediction, he's going to make it? He's going to get in? He's going to be nominated? He's going to
be a real shift by a couple of senators. If a couple of Democrats would announce that they are not going to support him, I think his nomination could go down for defeat. I think right now the odds are that he still will be confirmed.
And what do you think of the two announcements this week about moving on? First of all, the Pope is resigning, and I apparently that hasn't happened in hundreds of years. What do you think of that?
Well, I think it was a shock, I know, to people who follow it and who work on Christian-Jewish relations. He has been very outspoken on anti-Semitism and other subjects. He has been very open to receiving the Jewish delegations, as he did the conference presidents one year during a visit to Rome. So people were really taken aback, and now you'll have that process initiated. So now there's a race whether you'll have a new pope or a government in Israel first.
that's a great odds makers thing. I like that. That's very good. We're going to follow that very closely. And finally, another departure announced this week. Who would think both the Pope and Frank Lautenberg says they're leaving?
Well, I don't think it's a surprise. You know, Frank's age he's been more frail, so I think it's a smart and mature decision to make.
And I assume you've had many associations with him over the years, I would guess.
I certainly have. And, you know, the Lautenberg Amendment, which allowed for Jews in some endangered places to get in, and he has certainly always been outspoken. He was president of the UJA before he was elected, and was involved in Jewish communal affairs.
Lots going on, to say the least. Next week you're in the United States or Jerusalem or somewhere else?
God willing, we'll be in the United States and be able to talk about some of the issues that we haven't really followed, this Argentinian deal with Iran.
Oh, my gosh. There's a deal
really
between them?
Worse and worse, and Argentina's relationships with its neighbors is deteriorating, and this becomes, I will say something, that I think that Argentina is becoming for Iran the replacement for Venezuela post-Chavez, that they're concerned that those who follow Chavez may not sustain the relationship, and this will give a new base for Iran, and they were pouring money into Argentina, and the deal is a sham, and the international community, and we have spoken out about this a lot, can't allow them. The deaths of 120 people or more cannot be just an excuse. In order to enable some of these criminals to run for president, and the divisions inside Iran, which we've talked about many times, and people scoff at it and think that it's not real. The split between Ahmadinejad and Khamenei is real. We saw it play out in the Majlis this week. We see it play out in many other forums.
Are you concerned about the Jewish community of Argentina? Back to that for a second.
I am very concerned. I'm always concerned about the Jewish community in Argentina, not because I think there's any immediate threat, but if there's a backlash to some of these things, and once you bring the Iranians in, of course it makes it more difficult. We saw it in Venezuela, the changed atmosphere and attitude towards Jews and some of the very blatant comments that the leaders of Venezuela made. And while the relationship between Kirchner and the Jewish community, I think, was pretty good, it's certainly, I know from people there, that it's of great concern to them.
All right, Malcolm, enjoy Shabbat in Jerusalem.
We will. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. Thank you. Friday morning broadcast, our weekly update, every Friday, 7:40 in the morning, right here at JM in the AM.